So you might say love and fear are both motivators. They both work, but love works. It's much more effective. It's much more sustainable over time.
Hi, everyone. Drew Brode here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. Today's episode, we're talking with Dr. Kristen Neff on the topic of fierce self-compassion. Wouldn't you love to tap into the power of self-compassion, to be less critical on yourself, be less judgmental on yourself, and actually make progress in the goals that you care about? Well, if you do, this podcast is for you. Dr. Kristen Neff, she's an associate professor at University of Texas in Austin, and she's here to talk about her work in the space of highlighting all the clinical evidence and the tools that can be added to your toolbox when it comes to self-compassion. You know, self-compassion gets a bad rap sometimes. Sometimes we think it's a soft intervention, and it can be that, but it actually can be a fierce tool that can totally help you make progress on everything you want to make progress on. This podcast is fantastic. I hope you enjoy. Stay tuned. Hi, everyone. Before we jump into today's episode, I want to talk to you about my personal diet, which is something that I get asked about pretty often. So over the years, I've experimented with a lot of different things. I've done raw food diet when I first got started in the year 2000 down my health journey. I was vegan for a little while, about 7 years. So I had the chance to do that. Afterwards, I embarked on a more higher fat diet. And then when I learned about functional medicine, I realized that actually personalization is the key. It was all about finding out what works for you personally. So for me personally, after doing a very high fat diet for a while, I actually, through genetic testing, discovered that I didn't have certain genes that allowed me to break down saturated fats the same way as other individuals. So all that coconut oil and MCT that I was adding in gobs into my diet wasn't working for me. Again, that's just me personally. So after getting off of coconut oil, I was still looking for an oil that I could use for high temperature cooking and also an oil that I could add to my coffee every so often. So I made the switch to avocado oil, which is mostly monounsaturated fats, and I feel fantastic. And my blood looks better too. So I'm not saying coconut oil is bad for everyone, but in my case, it wasn't the best option. So this is the reason that I love Thrive Market. Thrive Market, it's an online store full of my favorite natural foods, home goods, and body care products, and they have everything you would ever want for any type of diet, whether you are a vegan, whether you are a raw foodist, whether you are doing paleo or something in between, whether you're solo or have a family. So as I notice, I need to eliminate one thing that's not working for me, or I want to try a new ingredient that's the right fit, I go to Thrive Market. It's my go-to to get those groceries, including my avocado oil, delivered right to my doorstep. Thrive Market has thousands of products, including gluten-free, dairy-free, certified, organic, paleo, fair trade. You name it, you can find it there. You can get all the healthy ingredients and kitchen essentials you need, and even things like toothpaste, skincare products, and non-toxic cleaning products for incredible prices. They also have grass-fed meats. They also have sustainable seafood options. So it's super easy to plan ahead, which is the key while we're all cooking and eating from home. So if you join Thrive Market today, here's the offer. You'll get $20 of shopping credit. That's a $20 bill that somebody literally hands you. $20 of shopping credit when you place your first order. Any order above $49 ships free. And since sustainability is a huge part of their mission statement, it'll be delivered in a carbon neutral shipping form from one of their zero waste warehouses. You gotta love companies that make great products but are also doing good. Thrive Market makes it so easy to change your diet and order nourishing ingredients at wholesale prices. Just go, if you want the offer for the Broken Brain community, just go to thrivemarket.com/brokenbrain. You can sign up there by filling up your cart today so you can get avocado oil if you want some too. Now, back to this week's episode. Don't forget, thrivemarket.com/brokenbrain. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast. I'm your host, Drew Proad. And each week, my team and I bring on a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and live more. This week's guest is Dr. Kristen Neff. Dr. Kristen Neff is an associate professor of educational psychology at the University of Texas at Austin and a pioneer in the field of self-compassion research. In addition to writing numerous academic articles and book chapters on the topic, she's the author of the book Self-Compassion, The Proven Power of Being Kind to Yourself. In conjunction with her colleague, Dr. Chris Germer, she has developed an empirically supported training program called Mindful Self-Compassion, which is taught by thousands of teachers worldwide. Together, they co-authored the Mindful Self-Compassion Workbook, as well as Teaching the Mindful Self-Compassion Program, a guide for professionals. She's also the co-founder and board president of the nonprofit Center of Mindful Self-Compassion. Dr. Neff, welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast.
Oh, thank you, Drew. I'm very happy to be here.
You know, when I first found out about your work, it really resonated with me because one of the backgrounds that I come from is the Jain tradition from India.
Okay.
My mom is from the Jain tradition in India. And we actually have one holiday, it's a big holiday every year, that's dedicated towards forgiveness and self-compassion to ourselves and also for others. It's called Paryushan. And I remember thinking, being young and growing up in that tradition, it just felt, especially being a young male who was really into sports and other things, I just felt, this feels so soft. This feels so like, what's the purpose of it? And through reading your work and the Dalai Lama and many other teachings that I got later on in life, I really understood the power of self-compassion, that it's not this soft thing, that it's actually truly powerful intervention that we can bring into our lives. And I think now more than ever. So I just want to thank you before we start for your incredible work, for connecting the dots for me as somebody who is probably a skeptic of my own tradition and background that I grew up in.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's right. So very insightful. Well, and you know, the idea of self-compassion, at least for me, comes from more Eastern contemplative traditions. And I think it's something that's really strengthened Western psychology, this merging of some of the more ancient wisdom with our modern psychological insights. So.
Because I even see in your bio, you know, one of the things that you acknowledge in your conversations is that when you really stepped into this foray, the State of the Union on self-compassion was nobody had really looked at it from an empirical standpoint.
Right. And so I learned about self-compassion when I started to learn Buddhist meditation. And it was actually a Thich Nhat Hanh meditation group. And teachers like Thich Nhat Hanh talk a lot about self-compassion. It's almost assumed that, of course, we need to be kind and forgiving and accepting of ourselves. But not so much in the West. Now, so people in the West had written about things like self-acceptance, but no one had actually operationalized or measured self-compassion, which is a little different than self-acceptance. So self-acceptance is, you know, accepting ourselves as we are, which is very important. But compassion, first of all, compassion is aimed specifically at suffering. So how do we relate to ourselves when we suffer? And that's usually when things go to hell in a handbasket, when we're feeling inadequate or things get really tough. And also adds in this sense of common humanity. So compassion inherently entails connectedness. The word from the Latin, come with, passion, suffer, to suffer with. There's an inherent connectedness we bring to compassion. And that's what draws on the wisdom of some of the Eastern spiritual traditions. When we recognize that we aren't alone, we are interdependent, this idea of the separate self is in many ways an illusion. And so when we suffer, we usually go straight down the rabbit hole of that illusion. You know, poor me, woe is me. It's just me who's imperfect. Everyone else is leading a normal, happy life. And it's just me who's failed, or it's just me who's going through this difficulty. And so self-compassion, by definition, includes other people. It includes the wisdom and the perspective of realizing, you know, everyone's imperfect. Everyone leads an imperfect life. You know, we're all in this together. And that's one of its big sources of strength.
You know, the beginning place of so much of self-compassion is just the awareness of where we are.
Yes.
And I've heard you share in articles and writings and different interviews about just the process of checking in. And so I would love for you to talk about that, especially I think that there's one time, I can't remember which conversation it was, but I heard you talk about the power of checking in when we go from different situations. You know, you go transition from one thing. I know before this, you were running some errands, taking care of stuff. You come into an interview. How do you go through the process of first checking in with yourself.
Yeah. And so there are actually three components to self-compassion. So two I've mentioned, the self-kindness and acceptance, and then the common humanity. But the third is actually what you're talking about right there, which is mindfulness. And so mindfulness is that process of checking in, of being aware what's happening right now in my, you know, mental and emotional state. And so, in fact, if we don't check in, if we don't pause to say, how am I doing in this moment, we actually can't be compassionate to ourselves. And so often what happens is we're so lost in the getting things done mode, right? You know, I'm rushing from appointment to appointment. The pandemic hits. I got to go to the grocery store. I got to stock up. You know, we're so much in doing mode, and we get kind of lost in what's happening, lost in, you know, the storyline. I don't mean that and like to belittle it, but it's kind of like we get lost in the thoughts about what's happening, and we have no perspective to step outside of ourselves. Well, we might to a good friend and just say, hey, how are you doing? You know, what do you need right now? And that perspective, which comes from the mindfulness, actually enables us to say, well, what is it that I need right now? Maybe I need a rest, or maybe I need to do something differently, or maybe I need to, make a different choice or leave the relationship, or who knows what the answer is. But if we aren't aware enough to ask and to pause and to check in, what is it that I need right now, we actually can't help ourselves very much.
When people step into that, it often feels like a catch-22. How do you become aware enough to become aware? What do you teach and talk about with other people?
Yeah, and so that is an interesting thing about mindfulness in general, right? Because mindfulness is awareness of awareness. And if you aren't aware, how do you become aware? And a lot of it is practice, right? So we know that we can train our brain through meditation, but also through just habitually asking the question, how am I doing? Or, you know, what do I need right now? We can actually train our brains to form that habit. But when we're really lost in the day-to-day unfolding of events, it can be difficult. And that's why we need to give ourselves reminders, like, you know, reading books or having some spiritual practice, maybe saying prayers or, meditating or reading your psychology books or reading a little note you put on your refrigerator. We need some sort of reminder to help us remember to be aware. And that's why building the habit of self-compassion or mindfulness or whatever it is so important.
So I want to go back to checking in with ourselves.
Okay.
Because for you, what does that look like when you when you wake up in the morning?
Yeah.
Is there a practice that you have, or is there a way, or is there a phrase that you're using or bringing in to actually see how you're doing in this moment?
Yeah. So for me, I am a meditator, but these days usually I do it either going to bed at night or waking up in the morning or quite frequently at 3 a.m. because 3 a.m. is when I wake up and I'm very wide awake, and usually whatever remnants of the stress or difficulty of the day comes to the fore. And so that's when I practice. For me, you might say my mindfulness bell or my reminder is my body. And so there's different ways you can remember to check in. But for me, tension in my body is my biggest reminder. So if I feel like a discomfort in my body, maybe it might be like a tightness in my stomach or a gripping feeling in my body, I've come to recognize that as, oh yeah, that's right, I'm struggling in some way. Because that tightness is usually some sort of emotional distress or some pressure, or maybe I'm resisting something that I don't like. And so once I notice that something's happening in my body, and it's quite interesting because sometimes I don't even have a storyline with it. Sometimes it's very clear, oh, I'm upset because this happened, or I'm upset because that happened. But often I don't even know why I'm upset.
I would say that's the case for a lot of people.
You know, yeah, and I just feel this tension. And then so I'll check in with my body. And what I'll do is I'll actually kind of put my awareness in the part of my body that's tight or that's tense. And sometimes I'll try to then kind of maybe put a hand over that part of my body, or maybe it's a tension, and just kind of check in and, you know, what is this? What's happening? And I'll kind of then go inward, and usually something will arise. You know, so I'll be able to notice what emotion it is that's arising. Oh, I see this is fear, this is uncertainty, this is anger, this is grief, right? And then I actually work with self-compassion to, first of all, we don't want to get rid of it, right? We don't use compassion to make the pain go away. We use compassion to hold whatever's arising in a way that actually allows it to heal. And then so I'll just allow myself, let's say, actually a couple nights ago, I had this very thing happen with grief. I didn't realize why I was feeling so bad. And I realized it was grief over a relationship that is kind of going through an end. And so I just worked with that grief and I allowed myself to feel it. And I comforted myself and I kind of, you know, expanding it to remember, well, this is everyone, this is part of being human. Relationships end. This is the way things work. It's, you know, it's nothing abnormal. I'm not abnormal. I'm not alone in this. And then I work with the kindness and caring for myself and saying some supportive things to myself. And so that's usually the way I do it. But so we've developed, Chris Germer and I, my colleague who you mentioned, we've developed the Mindful Self-Compassion Program. And I think there are 36 different practices and meditations and exercises you can do. So it really just depends what works for you. There's a lot of access points in, you might say.
You know, I think of the work around self-compassion in a similar stage as for a long time, people believed that the best way to raise kids was to hit them, right? If you wanted to teach a kid something, you had to hit them. And
that's right.
A lot of people who are proud parents would often say, oh, I'm thankful that my parents hit me and disciplined me this way because it forced me to become a particular type of human being. And in that same way, I often think of people equating, you know, no, we need to be hard on ourselves. We need to beat ourselves up every so often.
Yes.
And I know you get this question all the time, but I'd love to take that on because I think that's a great place to start during pandemic and even before, and I'm sure even after, people who relate to the idea of beating themselves up as a way to move forward in life.
Yeah, so I think it's a very good analogy. And in many ways, what self-compassion is kind of a way of reparenting ourselves, right? So we know that when we're parented by unconditionally loving and supportive parents, we feel more secure, we feel more connected, we feel more able to accomplish things in life.
And there's a lot of data to support that.
There's a lot of data to support that, right? And so what we're doing with self-compassion is we're treating ourselves like a good supportive parent. And I think the analogy you make is spot on because it used to be spare the rod, spoil the child. And the thing is, it does kind of work, right? There are parents, and the reason they believed in it is because they realize, well, when I punish my child with the paddle, they do what I say and, you know, they do achieve. And self-criticism also kind of works. You know, a lot of people get themselves through med school or law school through harsh self-criticism. The problem with both approaches is even though they kind of work, there's this whole negative fallout, unintended consequences of this approach that actually undermine their benefits. So fear is one, right? So, and let's just talk about the self-criticism now. What we know is although self-criticism can be used as a motivator, what it does is it also creates this fear of failure because you know if you fail, you're gonna beat yourself up. So you start developing fear of failure, you might start developing performance anxiety, right? And we know that performance anxiety actually undermines your ability to do your best. People procrastinate because of fear of failure. They might give up after a while because they just can't handle the pain of what am I gonna think about myself if I don't do as well as I like. So there's another way to motivate ourselves, which is like with parents. Luckily, we figured out with parenting that although corporal punishment works, it's much more effective to motivate with support and encouragement. So again, you know, the bottom line being that we love our children fully, but yet, you know, we also want them to do their best because we love them. We don't want them to fail because we care about them, right? And I'll tell you a little story, actually. This actually happened. My son, who's autistic, he had been homeschooled most of his life. Then I finally decided to put him in public school where there was, I just couldn't meet his needs anymore. But he wasn't really used to taking tests. And so this first test he took at high school, it came home, world geography test, F, unequivocal F. And so I had two ways to motivate my son. I could have used the approach of similar to self-criticism. I could have said, You're a hopeless, worthless failure. You'll never amount to anything. Ugh, I'm disgusted with you. If you don't get a better grade in your next test, that's it. You know, could you imagine if I said that to my autistic son who was just like doing something for the first time? What would have happened? Well, he may have tried harder, but he probably would have been so anxious it would have totally messed him up. He wouldn't have done well. He probably would want to like quit school. It would have been a disaster, right? So what did I do? First thing I did is I gave him a hug. Oh, I'm so sorry. Ouch. It hurts to fail. You know, we've all failed. It's really painful though. Hey, give me a hug. I made sure he knew that he was unconditionally loved and accepted, even though he failed. But then did I leave it at that and said, oh, well, you know, so what do you want for dinner, son? Of course not, right? Because I love my son and I want him to succeed. So I called up all his teachers and I figured out, oh, it's the way he was studying. And we figured out how to get him to study in a more effective way for him. Now he's doing much better. That's what parents who love their children do. They accept them, but they also support and encourage and give tangible help that allow them to reach their goals because they care. So you might say love and fear are both motivators. They both work, but love works. It's much more effective. It's much more sustainable over time.
With and all the downstream.
Sorry, go ahead.
With all that, without all the downstream consequences that come along with it.
Exactly. So, and there's a lot of research now. And I think because it was a lot of my fellow academics didn't quite believe that self-compassion was an effective motivator. So there's a lot of research actually comparing self-compassion or nothing. And nothing usually means the way people usually relate to themselves as criticism. And also self-esteem. And they find that self-compassion is a better motivator either than self-criticism or boosting your self-esteem. I mean, for many years, we thought that the way to achieve things in life is to say, you know, every day and every way I'm getting better and better and I'm great. And, you know, having kids feel so special and king for a day, queen for a day. But self-esteem also has its downsides because self-esteem, which I'm basically defining as judging yourself positively, that goes up and down based on your latest success or failure, right? So when you fail, you get a self-esteem hit. And although having a general sense of self-worth helps you to try again, basically is contingent on how well you're doing in the moment. And it's usually contingent on things like how much people like me, how attractive do I think I am, or how successful am I being?
All external factors.
And so self-compassion, you might say, is an internal form of self-esteem. So we feel worthy, but we don't feel worthy because we're special and above average. We don't feel worthy because we're succeeding and we aren't failing. We feel worthy because we're human beings who are intrinsically worthy of care. And so it's actually a more stable motivator and more effective even than self-esteem, which is really great because self-esteem, some days it's there and some days it's not, but self-compassion is there all the time. You might say self-esteem is a fair weather friend. Self-compassion is a true friend who's always there for you.
What do you know and what can you share with our audience about where in the brain self-criticism comes from, and potentially, what were some of the reasons evolutionarily that we needed it? I always find that the best way to understand things is to understand a little bit of the history and the origin story of it.
Yeah. And so to the extent that we know it, and this is based partly on Paul Gilbert's work, who's a brilliant English scholar. So self-criticism taps into the body's threat defense system, the fight, flight, or freeze response. And this is related to the sympathetic nervous system, things like cortisol, adrenaline. And so evolutionarily, when there's a threat in the environment, like a lion starts chasing us, we have three options. We're either gonna fight that lion, we're gonna run as fast as we can away from that lion, or we're gonna freeze and play dead, right? And then so when the sympathetic nervous system is activated, fight, flight, or freeze, we do release things like cortisol and adrenaline, and it's an effective response, and we want to have it in serious life-threatening situations. But the problem is nowadays, most of the threats aren't to our physical self, they're to our self-concept. So when we make a mistake, or we feel rejected, or we feel we failed, we act as if it's life and death, right? And then we get so activated and we get really upset and we start criticizing ourselves. Why do we criticize ourselves? Because the problem is ourself. The threat is coming from inward, So we fight, flight, or flee from ourselves. Fight is like criticizing ourselves, beating ourselves up. Flee is like when we flee into shame, we isolate ourselves, we like kind of hide ourselves from the world in shame. Or the freeze response is rumination. We get stuck, you know, the same thought goes over and over ahead, and we're paralyzed because we're hoping the danger will pass, right? And so the problem with that, well, first of all, things like heart disease and hypertension stems directly from being activated all the time in this fight, flight, or freeze response. So again, it's a useful response when the danger is kind of external, but it's not a useful response when the threat is to our self-concept. But, you know, this even reptiles have this fight, flight, or freeze response, but we're also mammals. And mammals developed another way to feel safe, and that is through connection, right? And through group bonding. So, for instance, a lizard mommy lays her eggs, and like there's no connection. The lizards crack out of the eggs and they run off and they're ready to go, but there's no attachment afterward. With mammals, young are born very immature, right? Very young, and they're born immature so that the brain develops actually over a long time so that we can adapt to the environment. Human beings are born the most immature. It takes between 25 and 30 years for the brain to continue to develop. And because of that, a system had to be evolved that would keep the infant or child safe with the parents and that would motivate the parents to care for the child. And that's our mammalian caregiving system, right? So this system, instead of like cortisol and adrenaline, it releases things like oxytocin and opiates. So when we feel connected to other people, especially family members, we feel safe, right? And so this is the system that self-compassion taps into. When we're kind to ourselves instead of harsh with ourselves, and when we remember we aren't alone, that we're part of this larger humanity, this activates the care system. And so things like heart rate variability, which is a marker of parasympathetic response, it makes us feel safe, more flexible, reduces our cortisol levels. So we know with self-compassion, this is what it does. It reduces cortisol, it increases heart rate variability, reduces things like amygdala activity, right? And so they're really, and this system evolved, but remember, we need both. Sometimes you need to like fight or flee, but we also sometimes need to tend and befriend, which is more of what the self-compassion response is.
And when you look at like perceived threats versus real threats, and most of the threats that we're going through today aren't actual threats. Yeah. Sometimes they can be, but they're not actual threats.
Yes.
And another component that I've also read that can play into this is that, especially as we're young, our brain has its own negativity bias because it's trying to protect itself. Where do you see the negativity bias and self-criticism and beating ourselves up? Where do you see the interplay between those?
Yeah, so it's a very good point. You're well read, Drew. You've done your research. Yeah, so the brain has a negativity bias, which also was evolutionarily adaptive, right? So our ancestors who were like, you know, Hakuna Matata, just all good, relax. They were more likely to be eaten by lions than a worrywart, obsessive, like, oh my God, what was that sound? Those ancestors, they were more likely to survive. So the brain is designed actually to focus on negative information more than positive information. Both have an important role, but there is priority placed evolutionarily on the negative information, which means, so for instance, if you get a work review and there's, you know, 19 positive glowing comments, but maybe one of, well, this needs work, that's the one you focus on, that's the one that sticks, because that's the problem that theoretically can be fixed. And the other ones, oh, it's not a problem, I can just take it for granted. So my friend Rick Hansen likes to say, you know, the brain is like Velcro for negative information and Teflon for positive information. The positive, not a problem, I don't need to worry about it, it just bounces off of us. And so what happens with self-criticism, again, is we feel threatened. Some people ask, why is it that we're so much more compassionate to other people than ourselves? And we know from the research that that is the case. Well, it's because when your best friend comes to you with the problem, you aren't personally threatened. So you've got more space and more room to tap into this other system, this care response to help them. But when you make a mistake or something happens to you, you do feel threatened. And then your negativity bias kicks in because you're just focused on the threat. And then your defense, your threat defense system gets activated, right? And so But self-compassion is, it's very interesting how it all works, because self-compassion is aimed at pain, is aimed at suffering by definition. So what happens is we become aware of something that's disturbing or that's frightening or that's sad or that's some sort of negative experience. And what we do is we hold that pain or negativity in compassion. So I said before, the three components of self-compassion are kindness, common humanity, and mindfulness. Another way to think of what that feels like is loving, connected presence. This is what it feels like to be in a self-compassionate state of mind. So when we're feeling grief or fear or anger or whatever it is, and we hold that in loving, connected presence, again, we don't make it go away, but we're like, well, this is really hard, maybe kind to myself in this moment. What happens is, first of all, the negativity is reduced because we aren't fighting it and resisting it. We know that we fight or resist a negative experience, it gets worse. When we accept it, it lessens, and loving connected presence is a positive emotion. So you're actually generating a positive emotion of care and compassion in conjunction with resisting less the negative emotion. And so that's probably how it works with the negativity bias. It actually reduces the negativity and it generates positivity in response in a way that can kind of get us out of that vacuum of the negative response, the negative reaction.
And there's something so powerful about acceptance, because on one side of it, there's the beating ourselves up and continuing down that pathway when it starts off. Yes. And on the other side is the, you know, let's will it into positivity. And neither one of them is accepting the situation as it is right now and just sitting with ourselves, because sometimes we don't feel good and that can be okay.
That's right.
And we can hold that.
And here's the thing. So I like to say that there's kind of a yin and a yang aspect of self-compassion. So the yin is the acceptance, very important. But there's also the yang, which is taking action to help ourselves if we care about ourselves. And so first we have to accept I hurt, or I accept, well, I made a big mistake, or, you know, I accept that I've got a cancer diagnosis or whatever it is, right? So you need to accept it with, again, this loving, connected presence. But again, we don't stay there. Just like my son, when he failed his exam, I fully accepted him as he was, but I didn't, but I also, after accepting him, then I took action to try to help him. And so the same thing with ourselves. So you get the cancer diagnosis, you need to fully accept it, but then you do what you can. Maybe there's, you know, change your diet, or, you know, start a certain health regime that actually may help. Or you may have a failure in a relationship or a failure at work. But you accept that, and you accept that with kindness and loving, connected presence. And then you say, and is there anything I can do to help? You know, and again, the difference is loving yourself isn't contingent on making things better. You love yourself regardless, but because you love yourself, you're also going to take action to try to improve things at the same time. So you know, Carl Rogers famously said, the curious paradox is that the more I accept myself, the more I can change. So they actually go hand in hand.
Yeah, it's beautiful. When you look at early childhood development and different attachment styles and communication, what do you see as being some of the biggest hurdles or blockages that prevent people from stepping into loving themselves, even once they are aware? So I become aware, okay, this is the pattern that's going on. Yeah. What are some of the old blockages that can get in the way?
Yeah, so we know, I mean, it's not surprising that early childhood upbringing is related to self-compassion as an adult. So people with secure attachment, which means their parents consistently met their needs and gave them a sense of love and worth, they're more self-compassionate as adults. Parents who are negligent, or, you know, people have insecure attachment, meaning they couldn't count on their parents to be there for them. It's harder for them to be self-compassionate as an adult. On people whose parents criticize them a lot, or just grew up in families where there was a lot of conflict, tend to be less self-compassionate because it wasn't modeled for them. And the people who got the you might say, the most struggle with self-compassion are people with abuse histories. Because again, compassion is formed out of this attachment system, this caregiving system. If things are going normally, when we feel, when we're with our family, we feel safe, we feel secure. But when in fact those signals of care from your parents are mixed with signals of fear because they're abusing you either physically or emotionally or in whatever way, then what can happen actually for people with abuse histories is when they start to be kind to themselves, it actually creates fear. We have a term for it. It's called backdraft. So backdraft is a term because, you know, when you go to a house that's on fire and you fling open the doors of the fire and the fresh air rushes in and the flames rush out, that can happen with their hearts. You know, if you grew up in a maybe very, you know, abusive or just insecure a family, you had to close the doors of your heart to survive, you know. And maybe it wasn't your family. Maybe it was just middle school. Maybe you were bullied in middle school. And the way you got through it and survived is you just shut down. You had to, you know, you had to out of self-protection. So you close down your heart and you kind of just get through. And then you start opening the door of your hearts with self-compassion. And you might say the fresh air of the love rushes in and then the old pain rushes out. It could actually be quite disturbing. When we teach our workshops, we talk about it.
And it could show up like, I'm opening my heart again. I'm going to get hurt. The same stuff that happened before is going to happen again.
Yeah. So there can be fear. There can be anger. There can be some people with like trauma histories can start disassociating. It can be actually quite destabilizing because how they stabilize themselves is by shutting down. So the thing to know about backdraft, this is actually a good sign. It's a good sign because it means you're opening your heart. It also means you have to go more slowly and, you know, hopefully work with a therapist and kind of, you know, put your toe in and close down and kind of open and close consciously to try to regulate how much the kindness you let in so that you get used to it and you go slowly. The good news is we know that a self-compassion is one of the best ways for people to deal with past trauma. You can actually earn adult secure attachment through self-compassion.
Give yourself the security that you were missing when you were younger.
Exactly. So you start to reprogram your brain. You start to give yourself that unconditionally loving, kind, supportive response that you didn't get as a child. And then you can start kind of reparenting yourself and form new attachment schemas.
I think that's so important to mention because for whoever's listening, that's like, well, I didn't grow up in that secure household. I didn't have that. You can literally give that to yourself starting today.
You can. And again, to remember, it may be a little bumpy at first because it will, you know, we say when you give yourself unconditional love, you immediately remember all the conditions under which you are not loved. But this is normal and it's natural. It doesn't mean you're doing it wrong. It means you're doing it right. But it just means you need to go a little more slowly and carefully. So for instance, one of the techniques we teach for giving yourself compassion is like putting your hands on your heart. And for many people, that feels really good. But for some people, maybe with an abuse history or just whatever, a lot of trauma in their background, that doesn't feel good. That feels scary. So we teach them, well, then pet your cat or take a bubble bath. There's lots of variations on how you can care for yourself. And you want to do things that actually feel good and help you feel safe. But there are a lot of options, luckily.
Going back to the beginning part of this conversation where I was sharing that, you know, you really were bringing the empirical view on self-love. And partly that has been highlighting the wealth of research that's out there. I'd love to just touch on a few of these because I think that, you know, you said for people who are not familiar with you, you said, put your hand on your heart. And I can immediately see some people saying, okay, where are we going with this?
Woo-woo. Yeah, yeah.
Woo-woo.
Yeah.
I would love to talk about some of the incredible research that's out there. And I'd love to first, you know, you've shared a couple times about some of the research on self-compassion in individuals in the military. I would love to hear about that. And then anything else you want to add in.
Yeah, yeah. And so it does sound a little woo-woo, which is why it's nice that there's so much empirical research. So I think at this point, there's like over 2,800 studies focusing on self-compassion. So it's really amazing how it's taken off. So this is an empirically supported approach. It's not just woo-woo. Even things like putting your hands on your body. Well, we know that touch activates the parasympathetic nervous system because for the first 2 years of life, babies and parents, they have no way of communicating other than touch and tone of voice. So our body is programmed, pre-programmed through evolution to respond with touch to feel calmer and feel safer. And we know it reduces cortisol activation, for instance.
And normally people think of it external touch, but it can also be yourself.
You can be self-touch. The body reacts very similarly between self-touch and other touch. But there's a lot of research. And one of the reasons the research is so good is because it does dispel these myths we have about self-compassion. For instance, we think it's selfish, we think it's self-indulgent, we think it's gonna undermine our motivation. And a big one is we think it's weak. We think it's a weakness. You know, self-compassion is soft. This is kind of the confusion between the yin and the yang self-compassion. Yin self-compassion is soft and tender. It's kind of loving, it's kind of accepting. But yang self-compassion, I like to call it fierce mama bear self-compassion. It's like, you know, protective. It's gonna protect you, or it's gonna give you the strength to get through. Because if you care about yourself, just like when you care for your children, you will do anything to help them. Or not even your own children. Think of a firefighter who jumps into a burning building to save the people from being engulfed by flames. That is an ultimate act of compassion, and it's very fierce. It's very strong. It's not soft or weak at all. So there's been a lot of research done with the military, and you might think, well, you know, military, do they like self-compassion? Well, they're teaching veterans, especially in the VA, self-compassion, because we know that it really reduces post-traumatic stress syndrome. So there's been research, for instance, showing that soldiers coming back from active duty who'd seen combat, that self-compassion predicted whether or not they developed post-traumatic stress syndrome from that combat. And it was a more important predictor than how much combat they had experienced. So in other words, more important than how much action you've seen, which does, of course, affect your level of PTSD, but even more important is, how did you relate to yourself after, you know, coming home and feeling all this moral injury and all this confusion and all this stuff that goes on for our veterans? Could you be supportive? Were you an ally to yourself? Or were you an enemy? Did you beat yourself up? Did you cut yourself down? Clearly, when you go into battle, you're going to be stronger if you have an ally inside your head than if you have an enemy inside your head cutting you down, right? And so we know through a lot of research, whether it's combat soldiers or raising special needs children or going through a divorce or dealing with cancer, you know, no matter what it is, when the going gets tough, being supportive, having your own back makes you stronger, not weaker. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of research to back that up.
And, you know, so much of that is not when you do become aware of self-compassion, you start trying some of this work, you don't get into the second car accident, which is beating yourself up for beating yourself up.
Yes.
Which is part of what you were talking about earlier.
Exactly. And so that's why it's really important to know that self-criticism, it comes from the fight or flight response or the threat defense response. We're just trying to stay safe. Right? If I look in the mirror and I beat myself up for what I see, what's actually happening is there's some part of me that's frightened that people won't love me or they'll reject me, right? And so I beat myself up hoping that either I'll beat them to the punch, I'm afraid of being criticized, and if I criticize myself first, maybe it won't hurt as badly. Or maybe I think that it'll help me to do something about it so I can change so that I'll be safe. So basically it comes from this very simple and innocent desire to be safe. And so what we're doing is, you know, and by the way, our inner critic can have some useful information. Our inner critic is usually very experienced. It's used to pointing out what may be problems. And so instead of beating ourselves up for beating ourselves up, we can say, oh, thank you. Thank you for pointing that out. You know, I'll consider that, right? But there's another, you might say, there's another part of myself I want to consult, which is kind of our mature, caring part, who, by the way, also sees the same problem. Also says, well, actually, what you're doing there isn't working out so well. It doesn't mean I don't love you. It doesn't mean you aren't acceptable. But it does mean maybe this isn't really helping you reach your goals. Why don't we try this? How can I help and encourage you? What can we learn from our past mistakes so that we can grow in a healthy way? Right. And so both voices are useful. But what happens is often with our inner critic, it like takes over the system and it's the only voice we can hear. So we want to make room for this more mature, more caring, more wise and far-seeing, that's not a word, but the part of us that has more perspective, so we call that part of ourselves to actually see, well, what can I learn? What can I do differently? Because I care, not because I'm inadequate.
You know, you use a fantastic word that you shared a lot in the past, and that's wisdom. You said wise.
Yes.
And I often think that sometimes when people step into self-compassion, the first question when they're looking at it from a theoretical lens is, okay, what is the game plan that it's going to consistently bring to this situation? So when I'm beating myself up, when I use self-compassion, does that mean that I always do X or I always do Y? And really what I hear your message being is that the real game plan is wisdom, because nobody knows contextually what's the right thing for you right now. Maybe you need to rest. Maybe you need to go for a run. Maybe you need to call a friend. Talk to us about wisdom and how important it is in the process.
Yeah, and that's so good. There's a story about a student who goes to his teacher, his wise teacher, and says, you know, master, this disciple who just came in, you told him to go left. And then the very next person he came in, you told him to go right, you know? And it's like, where are you coming from? Sometimes you need to go left. Sometimes you need to go right. It's all contextual. There's no one right answer, right? And so wisdom, and by the way, self-compassion is highly correlated with wisdom. I like to think of this sense of common humanity, this sense of perspective, the sense of seeing the bigger picture as the wisdom element of self-compassion, also the mindfulness. But wisdom is just really important. So self-compassion is asking the question, what do I need, right? And in some ways, that's kind of the mindfulness, what do I need? The compassion, the kindness part is, you know, this wanting to help ourselves, meet our needs, fulfill our needs. And the common humanity is kind of seeing how our needs are so interconnected with things that are so much bigger than ourselves. And so wisdom is able to put all of that together and say, what do I need right now? Sometimes, as you say, what I need is just to accept myself. Maybe I need to stop. Maybe I need to take a bath. Maybe I need to just love myself up, right? Maybe that's exactly what I need. But then maybe when you're doing that a lot and you aren't getting some things accomplished or it's actually harming you in some way. And so sometimes you need some tough love. You know, hey, listen, you got to get up and you need to exercise because your body is starting to hurt. You know, so for instance, in the pandemic, since we're in this pandemic, it's both, right? In some ways, we need to take it easier on ourselves and, you know, maybe cut ourselves some slack and, you know, maybe you aren't getting as much done as you wanted to. And that's important that we're kind of accepting and kind. But sometimes, you know, maybe it's not healthy anymore. Maybe at some point you need to say, hey, I need to do something. I need to get out and take a run, or I need to start that book project because I care about myself. And I know if I start that book project, it's going to make me happy. And therefore, because I care, I'm going to do that. And so no one from the outside can tell you the answer to what it is I need. We have to be willing to ask ourselves a question, and we need to be committed to giving an authentic response. Self-compassion, the research shows, it's not about being lazy or self-indulgent. People are more likely to do things that are sometimes difficult to take care of themselves, just like a parent does for their child. An indulgent parent is not a compassionate parent. A compassionate parent says, eat your vegetables, do your homework, you know, because I care.
Absolutely. Somebody who comes in and says, I care enough about you that I'm going to steer you in this direction.
That's right.
Which is the same thing that we can do for ourselves. We can actually be that friend that we need. And that's actually one of the teachings that you incorporate into the practice, is that how can you be that friend? How can you talk to yourself like that friend who would both come in and say, hey, that was a tough situation. You did your best. And it didn't work out. And also, I know you can do better. I see better in you.
Yeah.
And I want to encourage you to be able to bring that out, because I know you care about that goal or project or dream that you have.
That's right. That's right. And it's really both. And again, that's the yin and the yang. And so what a friend does is, the bottom line is unconditional acceptance. And yet, if they really care about you, they're going to tell you the truth. If you're doing something, maybe you're in a relationship that's really unhealthy, you know, and maybe if you ask them, tell me what you think, they're going to tell you the truth if they really care.
You know,
they'll accept you and they'll tell you the truth.
I often think of it as like the archetype of like a true grandparent voice. You know, for thousands of years, kids were, the wisdom really came from grandparents. You know, your parents' job was to put food on the table and make sure you don't die. And they're dealing with the day-to-day of that. Uh-huh. And then it's the grandparents who are like, look, when your dad or when your mom was that age, they were doing that too. They forget now because they're this. But this is where you need to really shape up. And I also know you're trying your best. It's like that voice. So we're so used to the voice that we think that is ours, that's the voice that beats ourselves up.
Yes.
We're so used to that voice. And it's funny because we listen to that voice without really any second thought. It's not weird to listen to that voice. It's not weird to beat yourself up and imagine that voice as being your own.
Yeah.
But then it's like to create another voice for ourselves. There's an archetype of another voice that can be on our head. For you, how do you actually, do you give names to those voices in your head? Are they the same voice? Like, how do you have it in your head so that you can separate the difference between the two?
Yeah. And so I think it just depends on the person. I mean, there are whole fields of psychology, you know, kind of parts therapy where you actually do identify particular voices like the compassionate self and the critical self. And that can be helpful that you can give them a different name. At this point, I don't, for me, it's pretty integrated, right? I kind of think of them as different parts of myself. So I think it just really depends on what's helpful for you. But it is, you make a good point. Often when people start practicing self-compassion, they think, it sounds so weird. You know, because I say, well, say to yourself what you'd say to a good friend in this situation. And it might be, you know, Kristen, this is really hard for you. I just think that maybe it's time to make a change or something like that. People think that's really weird, and yet they don't think it's weird to say, hey, yes, you really screwed that one up, Kristen. You know, right. we talk in the you voice all the time, and we talk to ourselves all the time. We're just so used, as you say, we're so used to the self-critical voice, we often don't even hear it. And then when we start letting in another voice that sounds weird at first, but then it becomes actually quite normal and natural after a while. So
let's talk hero's journey, origin stories. Where did your own passion and interest? I often find that a lot of individuals that are early in the space and have been doing this for quite some time, like yourself, and really some of the pioneers that are highlighting and making and connecting the dots for other individuals out there, they've gone through their own journey. They've gone through their own journey, and they often have found things besides their just general interests, there's been their own necessity. How much of your origin story would you feel comfortable sharing right now?
Well, if anyone's read my book, I air all my dirty laundry because I didn't want to come across as like this really together self-help guru who knows all the answers. You know, I've had a lot of personal drama, just like every other person. So for me, you know, I completely came to self-compassion from a place of personal need. So it was my last year of graduate school, and I had just gotten, ended a marriage, got divorced. It was very messy. I was feeling a lot of shame. I was feeling a lot of stress because I just spent 7 years getting my PhD with no guarantees of a job, lost the student loans, right? All that stress and pressure. And I was basically a basket case, you know, I was stressed and worried and feeling bad about myself. And so that's when I learned mindfulness meditation because I'd heard it was good for stress. And, you know, thank goodness the woman teaching the course the very first night talked about self-compassion, about the importance of being kind, supportive to yourself. And actually for me, even well before I learned what mindfulness was, I started practicing self-compassion and it made a difference almost immediately. And so most of my impetus for this work is my personal practice. Right. And so that was in 97. So I didn't even publish for another 7 years on self-compassion. And so again, all really, you might say the advances in my work, my deeper understanding of what self-compassion is, comes from my own experience, really seeing what it does for me. So for instance, as I think I mentioned, my latest work is more about the yin and the yang of self-compassion. Right, how there's the soft, tender side, but there's also kind of this fierce mama bear side. You know, that comes from some experiences I had actually, a friend of mine who was found out to have been being sexually abused. And it was kind of, and someone I knew very closely and trusted, and it was kind of a Me Too moment. Mm. And so actually the Me Too movement is partly what has inspired me to focus on this fierce side of self-compassion. Because I think especially women who are so socialized to be yin, and we aren't allowed to be angry, and we aren't allowed to be, you know, agentic and out there, or people think badly of us if we are. It's like, that really inspired me to say, hey, this has got to change. We have to be fully own our young, powerful side if things are ever going to change, and we're going to be able to deal with the way we've been treated in many ways. And so that's another just example of how my personal life has really driven my theoretical work and my research.
And growing up for you, how was that balance? Did you have examples around you of the yin, the yang, and how did that shift your ability to give yourself that self-compassion?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So my father left when I was very young. So I write about it in my book because I had kind of the hurt little girl syndrome because my father wasn't around. My mother was great and she was strong and very supportive. Thank goodness. I think that's why I turned out the way I did. But my father wasn't really around. And so it created feelings of hurt that would play themselves out in my romantic relationships. Right? And then, so it's for me, it's kind of funny. I'm very young just by personality. I've got a lot of energy. I'm very kind of, I get things done, right? And I joke, my colleague, Chris Kermer, he's a man. I say, you're more yin than I am, Chris. And he's like, yeah, you're probably right. You know, so it's not just about gender. So for me, I had to learn how to be, you might say, yin in the sense of how to really give myself what I missed from my father, which is things like, you know, telling myself that I love, you know, and it sounds weird. It's not narcissistic, but I'll actually say out loud, you know, Kristen, you know, I just love you so much. I respect you. I value you. I'm here for you. I support you. All those things that maybe I didn't get from my father, that masculine energy when I was younger, I've actually learned to give that to myself. Right? Mm. And then the yang side, like I say, I think maybe just by temperament, I have a lot of yang energy. And so, funny, the yang, it's not only just about protecting ourselves, it's like it also is what we turn outward to change the world, change the social environment when things aren't fair or they're harming us. And I've experienced, like in academia, some of the backlash that happens to women who are very successful, for instance. People don't like successful women. So that's what kind of partly why I'm writing this book on the yin and yang of self-compassion. So I'm kind of having to really learn how to integrate my yin and yang side. And I like that better than masculine and feminine side. We use those terms.
They're so fixed. And
so fixed. And also because men are both and women are both. And the whole problem is that we've gendered these things.
Yes.
You know? And so a big part of my journey is integrating my yin and yang side in a way that's healthy. And I think I've made a little bit of progress. I've been working on it a lot the last couple of years. So for a long time, I was working on being yin with myself and giving myself that support. And the yang was kind of almost disconnected from my yin side, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like I was this other person. I was this strong, successful academic who could get in any intellectual argument you wanted to throw my way. It was kind of really disconnected from my more soft, tender side. So what I've been working on doing is integrating both. And it feels a lot better, I have to say, and, you know, really owning both and having them constantly in dialogue, these two sides of myself.
I think the word dialogue is key because, as you said earlier, when we are in this place of wisdom, even when we're not being critical with ourselves, even when we are in love with ourselves, even when we have self-compassion and we're trying to think about the right way to solve a problem, there's different approaches that are there. And when we're in wisdom, we can tap into that approach and see, okay, do I want to be more aggressive right now? Or do I want to take it a little bit more soft, be a little bit more chill with it? Mm-hmm. And I think that anybody, man, woman, whoever it might be, if you can tap into that and know just intrinsically what the right approach is, just from the wisdom and the awareness that comes from tuning in, then there's just a harmony that's brought to life.
That's right. Yeah. So I think it's really important. And just to be aware of it, even just to be aware of, okay, well, what do I need right now? Do I need more yin or do I need more yang? That even that question is very, very important to ask.
Absolutely. Do you mean in terms of like what you need from, it could be yourself or the world around you?
Both. Yes, both, you know. But the nice thing about self-compassion is that sometimes, you know, maybe sometimes what I need is I really need a hug and I need someone just to tell me that they love me. But sometimes that person isn't available.
Right.
And so when that happens, right, when that happens, and that loneliness is a huge epidemic, the first thing we need to do is acknowledge the pain of that because that hurts. And then we need to try to give that to ourselves, you know. Can I hug myself? Can I tell myself I love myself? It's not a way of like replacing the other, But just the reality is that it's not always available. So we need to honor the grief of the fact that maybe we're lonely and it's not only available, but that doesn't mean we're helpless. We can actually do a lot more than we might realize in terms of generating this sense of connection and love with ourselves.
And there's a lot of vehicles to get there. I can remember, I've never resonated with journaling. It's just not something that I enjoy.
Yeah, me either.
Yeah. And it's not something that I get a lot of benefit from. So I would try, especially in the early days of learning about and studying Buddhism and different philosophies and traditions and trying different exercises and things like that. But one of my most favorite things to do instead of journaling is I talk out loud to myself. I'll be driving in the car, I'll be walking. And for anybody who thinks this is weird and doesn't want to be judged for it, just put in headphones. People don't know who you're talking to anyway. Yeah. They don't have to be plugged into your phone. And I just start talking to myself and I look at the situation. And often for myself, it'll start off with, okay, I don't know why, but I'm not in the best mood today. It can even start off with that. Sometimes I don't even know, going back to the earlier part of the conversation, I don't even know why I'm not feeling in the zone. Normally I feel good. Normally I feel in the zone. Normally I feel excited for the day. So I might just say, okay, you feel a little off. Okay, it might be you didn't sleep as well, but whatever it is, even if you don't know right now, just it's okay. You're a human being. You're going to do your best today. You don't have to do everything that's there. And I'll say that out loud and I'll get the joy and the reflection that comes from asking and answering questions to myself.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just to share that it doesn't have to happen exactly the same way for everybody.
And so for instance, meditation, we find in our research that meditation is a great way to build new habits. It's a great way to learn self-compassion and mindfulness, but equally powerful is just when you notice that you're being unkind to yourself, say, what would I say to a friend in this situation? And then you just say the same thing to yourself. That's equally as effective, right? So it doesn't have to take time out of your day, for instance. So just as an example, we've just developed a training program for healthcare workers who they do not have time to meditate. They don't have time to practice. They don't have time to journal. So we taught them things that they can do on the job. For instance, when they're at the bedside of a patient, they breathe out compassion for the patient and they imagine breathing in compassion for themselves, acknowledging, well, I feel overwhelmed, I'm so tired, this is hard for me. And then the patient, but it's so hard for them. So the flow of compassion goes both ways and they just use it by focusing on their breath in the moment. You can do things like that, which are incredibly effective that don't require any time out of your regular day.
Well, Dr. Neff, this has been a fantastic conversation. And, you know, at the beginning when we were just catching up individually, you said it'd be nice for you to share a practice. If you have time, I'd love for you to share a practice. It's 10:20 or so. It's 12:20 your time. How are you doing on time?
I'll do a 10-minute practice, actually.
Okay.
You know what I'll do as I often teach a practice called the self-compassion break, which is on my website. If anyone wants to go, it's at selfcompassion.org. But I'm going to teach a different one. It's kind of more related to what we're saying. This is a practice that more generates the yin self-compassion, kind of when you need some acceptance. And it can be, it's a way of similar. This is the practice I do when I wake up at 3 a.m. that we talked about. So I'm going to just lead through a short version of this. Okay. So I'm going to close my eyes. You can close your eyes if you want. And it helps to close your eyes just so you can be a little more introspective, right? And settle into your body. Okay, and so I'd invite you to think of some situation in your life right now that's causing some emotional difficulty. Okay, please don't choose your most overwhelming difficulty, because if you're overwhelmed, you actually won't be able to concentrate. Something that's challenging. So maybe it's anxiety of you know, catching the coronavirus, or you're worried about someone, or maybe you're feeling lonely, or maybe you're feeling economic insecurity, right? So some situation you choose, something that feels right to work with, not too big, something that's distressing. Just call up that situation in your mind's eye or think what's happening. All right, and then I would invite you to just ask yourself, what emotions am I feeling right now? and there may be several, right? And so when you feel the emotion, just kind of make a soft mental note of what it is. Oh, I see, that's loneliness. Or that's uncertainty. Or fear. Or grief. Sadness. Right, whatever it is, we're focusing on a difficult situation, so these will be negative emotions typically. So see if you can just kind of explore what's here. Maybe what's here is confusion. Maybe you don't even know, and you can work with that as well. And then see if you can decide on what seems to be the strongest emotion for you right now. Just choose one to work with. Again, it could be confusion, or maybe it's something like sadness, fear. And then I would invite you to see if you can find where you are actually feeling that emotion in your body as a felt sense, right? So it might be like a hollowness in your chest, or gripping in your throat, or a tightness in your stomach. Or maybe you can't locate it exactly. It may be just an overall sense of stress or uneasiness. Just drop out of your head now and just feel your body. Where do you actually feel this uncomfortable emotion as a physical sensation? Okay, and so the first thing I'd invite you to do is see if you can soften your body a little bit around that felt sense of the emotion, right? So usually difficult emotions are like kind of tension in our body. See if you can soften a little bit around it, kind of relaxing your body around it, making a little more space for it, a little more room for it. Then we want to be kind to ourselves because this is difficult. So one thing I'd invite you to do is see if you can put a hand over the place in the body where you're feeling the difficult emotion. Right? Put a comforting hand. If you can't figure out exactly where the emotion is, you can just put your hand on your heart or some other place, your stomach, to just give yourself the sense of support. Use physical touch. Kind of soothe your body, to reassure your body that you're here, and of your own presence and support. And then asking yourself, you know, what do I need to hear right now to support and care for myself? Right? You might imagine, you know, what would I say to a good friend who is in the exact same situation I'm in? Types of words of support and kindness would I naturally say to someone I cared about? And just trying this out with yourself. Maybe something like, I know how hard this is for you. I'm here for you. Or, you know, it'll be okay. Or, I love you and care for you. Right? Whatever it is you need to hear, just like you might say to a good friend. And then kind of held in your own loving, connected presence, see if you can just simply allow the emotion to be there, right? No need to fix it or make it go away, right? Just simply allow things to be as they are in this moment. There may be actions you'll take later, but for now, in this moment, this is how it is. Can I allow myself to feel as I feel? But with great love. ready, you can let go of the practice and open your eyes. So that's, I did it short. I actually have this practice on my website. It's called Working with Difficult Emotions, Soft and Soothe Allow is the nickname.
So that's great.
That's the type of practice. It really helps to go into your body because your brain is where the storyline is and often generates like the doomsday scenarios or the fear. If you move to your body, you can actually give yourself compassion in your body and it's more slow moving. And in many ways, it goes in deeper.
And I think the friend, you know, what would you say to a friend or what would a friend say to you? I think that's very important because it really just adds a nice context for me, you know, the feelings that came up and where I was putting attention on my body, which was my, you know, my abdomen region. Uh-huh. When you had said like, you know, checking in and like the way that a friend would communicate to you, you know, communicate to yourself, it's an acknowledgement of like, you're doing fantastic. Like the things that are there. You know, there's always things in your life that you feel that should be further along or should be here, should. And then you check in and you're like, if I actually was aware of everything right now, I know that it was okay for me in this moment. You know, that's what came up for me. Dr. Neff, thank you so much for that practice and for everything that you shared. I know you're very active on Twitter. And so we'll have the link to that on in our show notes. Any other places you'd like to direct our audience who'd like to keep in touch with you?
Well, I say if you just Google self-compassion, you'll find my website, selfcompassion.org, and they can sign up for a newsletter. But I've got a lot of practices. You can test your own self-compassion level. If you're a research nerd like me, I've got like hundreds, maybe even thousands at this point of research articles on my website by various scholars. So it's kind of a nice starting place for you.
And the new book that you were alluding to earlier, when will that be out?
Well, it won't be out until next year. I'm still writing it, but next year it's will be by HarperCollins, and it's called Fierce Self-Compassion. At least for now, you never know; they may try to change the name. But
well, I love the title, and I can't wait to have you back on to get a chance to talk about it then.
Okay, thanks, Drew.
Thank you again. Such a pleasure.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.